really stuck out with me this morning. He made a comment that you are what you eat. I must be the Stay Puft Marshmallow guy, so if you guys remember Ghostbusters. Well, good evening, everybody. It's good to be back with you this evening, and it was a bit different for me preparing this lesson because I realized I was sort of running out of the material that I had been going off on for the last couple of years, which was around God and around our relationship with God and getting to know God. So me being the type of person I am, I was like, well, I've got to find something that's unique in the scriptures, something that maybe we really don't hear a lot about. So our topic tonight is going to be called The Wells of Isaac, The Wells of Isaac. Now, when you think about wells, they've always had a great strategic importance, particularly in the arid parts of the Middle East. You see, wells produce water, and it's life for families and for communities, and they were always, always also a place of strife and dispute. And there are many times in the scriptures where wells are often given meaningful or spiritual names. And when a new well was dug in an unoccupied area, it was immediately named. And the surrounding land was claimed when you dug this well. And as a community would develop around this area, it became the life source for that community. But it also became a landmark for the stranger who might be passing through. You can think of Jesus when he was in Samaria and he stopped by Jacob's well. There are some notable events that occurred at wells in the Old Testament. We see one where there was the revelation of God to Hagar in Genesis chapter 16, verses 7 through 14. There was Rebekah's encounter with Abraham's servant in Genesis chapter 24, verses 15 and 16. Of course, I just mentioned Jacob's well, which is found in Genesis chapter 29, verses 9 and 10. And then we have David's well in 2 Samuel 23, verse 15. Usually, if not always, these well events always led to some life-changing experience for those that were involved in the scriptures. Now, when we think about what a well is, you might have some ideas in your mind. The dictionary definition of it is a spring or natural source of water. Now, that's just one definition. Another one is, quote, a hole drilled into the earth to obtain water, petroleum, natural gas, brine, or sulfur. It's also been referred to as a place where water issues from, a spring or a fountain. But when it comes to the Bible, the biblical uses of the word is used in the same sense as it being a pit, a fountain, or a spring of water. Now, the most notable well or spring that we can think of is the Gihon Spring. If you look at the topography of the city of Jerusalem, particularly the old city, there is only one water source in the entire city, and that is the spring of Gihon. And that spring has been bubbling, and I don't mean just a little trickle bubble. I'm talking massive amounts of water have come from that spring for thousands of years. If you know your history, that is the spring that was underneath the altar when the temple was built. And if you think about the thousands upon thousands of animal sacrifices that took place, you needed a good water source to clean things up. But it also had a different meaning. When you think about it being under the temple, the idea was that it is the living source, the life source. And so you have the temple, the water, everything combined together gives us God's graces and his goodness. The term well is also used as a figure of speech to illustrate moral and spiritual concepts, as in Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 11, where it says, "The mouth of the righteous is a well or a fountain of life, but the mouth of the wicked conceals violence." And of course, the most famous well of all that we've talked about is in John chapter 4 and verse 14, where Jesus says, "But whoever drinks of the water that I will give him shall never be thirsty. But the water that I will give him will become in him a well or a fountain of water springing up to eternal life." There's another interesting expression which has a spiritual implication, and it's found in the book of Isaiah, chapter 12, in verse 3, where he says, "Therefore you will joyously draw water from the wells or the springs of salvation." And salvation has several distinct aspects and can be likened to a well. And according to John chapter 4 and verse 11, that well is deep. Because you see, this is a well of forgiveness. It is a well of redemption, of reconciliation, of justification, of regeneration, of sanctification. The question I have for you is, do you gather joy when you draw water out of the well of life? Let us not say that we, quote unquote, have nothing to draw with, as the Samaritan woman did, because you see, we have the scriptures which to draw out the deep understanding and the deep life that is contained within the pages of God's word. Do we have a thirst for this water? Because the wells of the word have infinite resources to strengthen our faith and sustain our hope in a better future. But as I said, tonight we're going to talk about Isaac and the wells of Isaac. And as I begin this particular topic, I should point out that Isaac is rather unique in the Old Testament. Because you see, he is the son of the famous guy, Abraham. And he is the father of a famous son by the name of Jacob. However, Isaac, we know very little about when you think about it. There are basically, okay, here's my numbers. Sorry, you know, this has got to come in. There are 13 chapters in Genesis detailing the life of Abraham. And there are 10 chapters describing the life of Jacob. But where we have Isaac as the primary character, there's only one chapter in the Bible. Now, he is in other parts of the scriptures, but where he is the primary character, there's only one chapter, and that's Genesis chapter 26. And when we look at Genesis 26, we're going to find out that Isaac faces some serious challenges in his life. It is interesting to observe that when Isaac appears from Mount Moriah, and if you're not familiar with Mount Moriah, remember this is the altar place where Abraham took Isaac up to offer him as a sacrifice. Mount Moriah is where the Temple Mount is today. That's where the Dome of the Rock is located. But after that story, he is going out to meet his coming bride. And the scripture tells us in Genesis chapter 24 and verse 62 that he is coming from the way of the well, Lahairoi, meaning well of the living one that sees me. Isaac chose to live near this well to prepare a place for his bride because this place was a place of divine grace and revelation to not only him, but to his father. It is here that Abraham gave all that he had to Isaac, and it was also here that God blessed him, according to Genesis chapter 25, verses 5 through 11. This was a place of spiritual prosperity. So let's begin our text tonight, Genesis chapter 26, starting in verse 1. It's a lengthy reading, but I don't have too many pages to go through, so I think we'll be in good shape. Now there was a famine in the land besides the previous famine that had occurred in the days of Abraham. So Isaac went to Gerar to Abimelech, king of the Philistines. And the Lord appeared to him and said, "Do not go down to Egypt. Stay in the land of which I shall tell you, and sojourn in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and to your descendants I will give all of these lands, and I will establish the oath which I swore to your father Abraham. I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heaven, and I will give your descendants all these lands, and by your descendants all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. Because Abraham obeyed me and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws." So Isaac lived in Gerar. And when the men of the place asked about his wife, he said, "She is my sister," for he was afraid to say, "my wife," thinking the men of this place might kill me on account of Rebekah, for she is beautiful. And it came about when he had been there a long time that Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out through a window and saw, and behold, Isaac was caressing his wife Rebekah. Then Abimelech called Isaac and said, "Behold, certainly she is your wife. How then did you say she is my sister?" Does this story sound familiar? It does, doesn't it? And Isaac said to him, "Behold, I said, I might die on account of her." And Abimelech said, "What is this that you have done to us? One of these people might easily have lain with your wife, and she would have brought guilt upon us." So Abimelech charged all the people, saying, "He who touches this man or his wife shall surely be put to death." Now Isaac sowed in that land and reaped in the same year a hundredfold, and the Lord blessed him. And the man became rich and continued to grow richer until he became very wealthy. For he had possessions of flocks and herds and a great household, so that the Philistines envied him. Now all the wells which his father's servants had dug in the days of Abraham, his father, the Philistines, had stopped up by filling them with earth. Then Abimelech said to Isaac, "Go away from us, for you are too powerful for us." And Isaac departed from there and camped in the valley of Gerar and settled there. Okay, so we have a few things that are going on here, and these are challenges that Isaac had to face when he was in this land. We have adversity in the form of a famine, another famine, just like Abraham had to deal with. And we have the adversity of Isaac's own making, but in both situations, God still blessed him in spite of these circumstances. And I don't have enough time tonight to go into any great detail over the comparisons between the two texts, but we need to remember that Abraham himself actually did go to Egypt. So Isaac is trying to do the same thing, and God puts his hand out and stops him. Now, let's think about what Isaac's trying to do. There's a famine in the land. I've got a lot of flocks that I have to feed. I have a lot of people that rely on me. And when you need food and water for your flocks and your herds and your people, and you cannot find it where you are at, you've got to go get it somewhere else. So he leaves the area and tries to go to Egypt. But God steps in and tells him not to move, but to stay right where he is. And at this time, God also reaffirms the covenant that he had given his father Abraham. He gave it to him in chapter 12, chapter 15, chapter 17, chapter 22, and now in chapter 26 in verse 4. So Isaac, listening to the word of God, decides to stay in the land of Gerar. But as he stays, he runs into Abimelech, who is the king of the Philistines, and we find here that Isaac continues to follow the example of his own father. So let's stop for just a second. We're going to take a look at something. The word Abimelech means "my father is king." This is a title. This is not a person's name. This is very similar to some of the others that we have, like Melchizedek was a name, but it was also a title. Adonai Zedek is a name, but it's also a title. And the reason I can say this is because if you look back in Genesis chapter 20 and 21, who does Abraham run into? A guy by the name of Abimelech. It's not the same guy because there's almost 200 years between these two stories. So unless he was really good, there's a problem there with trying to make that work. Not to mention, if you think about it, if this was the same guy, don't you think in his mind he would have remembered the last time this happened to him? So I don't think it's the same person. And we're going to see this with the general of his army also, a guy by the name of Phicol. It means great, and it's a title that was given. So if we remember, twice in his life, Abraham had lied in a very similar way because he was scared of what the locals might do to him. He had lied once to Pharaoh, and he had lied a second time to Abimelech. Now, it's interesting that Isaac did virtually the same thing, and you want to talk about like father, like son. Boy, did he learn how to do things. Because he says the same thing that his father said. This king, though, happens to see Isaac and Rebekah caressing each other, and he figures it out. But instead of punishment, he issues a decree. He says, anyone who touches this man or his wife shall surely be put to death. Difference between the two stories. So here, what seems to be a blessing from God in an order of protection against this king presents a stressful situation that Isaac had brought upon himself. But there's a deeper lesson that in when we see what God told Isaac to stay in this land in spite of this famine, it's sort of putting a huge challenge on Isaac's faith. Because you see, God had just told him, I want you to stay here. You're going to be blessed. I'm going to take care of you. And what's the first thing he do? He runs in fear because he thinks something's going to happen to him. So his faith was weak, at least for a moment in time. Now, let's take a look at something here. When we look at verse 12, we start to see results of this blessing that Isaac gets. You see, the normal yield for a crop at that time was maybe 25-fold. Sometimes, if you were good, you might get 50-fold back from one planting of corn. But notice what happens. Even in a famine that the Philistines were also going through, we find in verse 12 that the seed that Isaac sowed brought back 100-fold from what he had planted. And remember, Isaac is a nomad, just like his father was. His primary duty and work was not as a farmer, but as a nomad. There's also something else that makes this significant. It was what Isaac was able to do with this crop. So not only does everybody see him with all of this, he's the guy in town, right? You need corn? I'm your guy. So he sells his crop and earns money and extra flocks and other things from people. And so he is making a huge profit, which is making him very, very wealthy. We notice in verse 13 that Isaac became rich and continued to grow richer until he became very wealthy. And it even got to the point in verse 14 that the Philistines started to, as the Bible says, envy him. This, by the way, is the first time in the Bible we see the word envy. They envied Isaac, but instead of setting up camp and protesting, we find in verse 15 that the Philistines allowed their envy to grow in their hearts, and they filled the wells that Abraham had dug in that area from many years before. Now, think about this for a minute. You're in the middle of a drought, a famine. You take the very water sources that are providing, and do you just take them over and say, this is my water? No, they filled them up. They capped them and made them useless to everybody, not just to themselves. By the way, that's the first time we see vandalism in the scriptures, is when they filled these up. The reason they did this was they would hope that Isaac would no longer be able to water his flocks and take care of his crops, and that he would be brought down to the same level that the rest of them were at. But instead of applying for a job with Isaac and seeing what they could do to earn some extra money, they just tried to do whatever they could do to destroy him. The king then asked Isaac to leave, and he did. So if we apply this to today and we look at this, it seems there might be a lesson in the fact that God has the ability to take care of his people, even in very stressful situations. Anybody live through 2020? God was still there and God still being God and doing all the things that God does and expecting the same things for us in spite of everything that happened in 2020. When the future looks bleak, even though we cannot see our way out at times, and whenever trouble seems to be in front of us, we just need to turn to God because he has an ability that we don't. And like he said to Isaac, sometimes the answer may involve digging in and trusting God to help at the right time. God can take care of his people in bad economies, in droughts, in challenging home situations, even in a class when a teacher seems intent on destroying our faith in God. If you haven't seen any of those stories, just get on the internet. God has the ability to bless us even in adversity. I'm sure that Isaac learned something about all of this when he was tied up and nearly sacrificed by his father, only to be stopped by an angel at the very last second. So when Isaac starts heading down to Egypt to provide for his family, and God tells him to stay right there and that he would provide for him, Isaac took God at his word and trusted God to make things right, as God did, as he promised. And it must have taken a lot of faith to plant in this dusty environment. It hasn't rained in a while. We can't get any food. No crops are growing. But yet he takes the time to plant crops in this area. And we see this so often in the Bible. Dip 7 times in the Jordan. March around the city of Jericho. Go and borrow empty vessels from your neighbors, not just a few, but many. Roll the stone away from the mouth of the tomb. Fill the jars with water, and on and on and on. Isaac was blessed in spite of his adversity. So Isaac started digging his father's wells again, which the Philistines had filled in. So we're going to continue in verse 18. Then Isaac dug again the wells of water, which had been dug in the days of his father Abraham, for the Philistines had stopped them up after the death of Abraham. And he gave them the same names which his father had given them. But when Isaac's servants dug in the valley and found there was a well of flowing water, the herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with the herdsmen of Isaac, saying, quote, the water is ours. So he named the well Eshek, because they contended with him. Then they dug another well, and they quarreled over it too, and he named that one Sitna. And he moved away from there and dug another well, and they did not quarrel over it, so he named it Rehoboth. For he said, at last the Lord has made room for us, and we will be fruitful in the land. So the conflict here is over water. Now, we don't necessarily see this today like they would have back then. I go into my house, I turn on the spigot, and I usually get water out, usually. Depends. Need a spigot. But for Isaac, this was a matter of life and death, and to dig a well was incredibly hard work. Some estimates in some of the wells that they have found was over 200 feet that they would have to dig. Now, they didn't have equipment like we have today to dig a well, because not only did you dig it out, but you also had to encase it so that it wouldn't collapse on itself. Amazing feat of engineering on their part. You see, when you had a well that you built back then, you were sending a message to the people around you. You were saying that this land is my land. This is my area. And so the idea here of filling these wells up was not because of the water. It was because they were saying, you don't belong here. This isn't your land. And that's why they had done this after Abraham died, because they wanted everybody to know this was not Abraham's land. So he redigs the wells that his father had given him, or in the land that he had given. And he gives it the same names, but those names obviously are not the names that he chooses now. We do not know what those names are. These are different. So they start arguing with him and say, this is not your land. They protest, they fight and argue. And each challenge, each new well that Isaac has to build is more work that he has to go through. So he does all the work. He puts all the sweat, the blood, and the toil into that, only to have somebody else come in. But you know what Isaac does? He says, that's okay. We'll go over here instead. And he does that 3 times. The first well, Eshek, means contention or fight. The second well, Sitna, means hostility or opposition. It is the same root word in English for the word Satan. In other words, Satan is our adversary. Satan stands in opposition to us, which is what his name really means, to be opposed to God. This was the name that Isaac gave to this particular well. So he moves on to a third location, which there is no opposition. And he calls this one Rehoboth. The Lord has made room for us. But this one is different because it's away from there. In other words, what we're seeing happening is he had gone all the way out to the land of the Philistines, and he's starting to make his way back to where he had come from. So why all the trouble with these wells? Well, he wanted to stop the trouble because they were not in the land that God had promised. He may not have recognized this, but this is what was happening. So he comes back to a place called Be'er Sheva. And if you remember the story in Genesis chapter 12, we have this story of Lot and Abraham. And Abraham tells Lot, you need to go somewhere else. We're too big. If you go north, I'll go south. If you go south, I'll go north. You decide where you want to go. This is the same thing that Isaac is doing here. I recognize my flocks and my wealth is too much in this inhabited area where you are at. You decide where you want to be, and I will go somewhere else. You see, the thing here is that sometimes when we get blessings from God, we assume those blessings are for us. But in fact, what God is blessing us to do is to bless other people. You know, Dave Ramsey has a statement at the end of his class. If you've ever been through Financial Peace University, he says that the reason you get yourself out of debt, the reason you go through all of this is so that you have money to give. And he says the reason you give is because God gave first. So those blessings that we get are really to bless others. And what Isaac has decided that he's going to bless them by giving them all this land back, including the wells that he built. Then we get to verses 23 through 25. Then he, Isaac, went up from there to Be'er Sheva, and the Lord appeared to him the same night and said, I am the God of your father Abraham. Do not fear, for I am with you. I will bless you and multiply your descendants for the sake of my servant Abraham. So he built an altar there and called upon the name of the Lord and pitched his tent there, and there Isaac's servants dug a well. So let's take a look at Be'er Sheva real quick. If we go back to Genesis chapter 21, we have a story with Abraham and Abimelech, very similar, but they have an oath that they come together on. And in verse 31, it says, therefore that place was called Be'er Sheva, because both of them had sworn an oath. The word Be'er in Hebrew means well, and Sheva is the number 7. Now, this is really interesting, because if you think about it, it's basically the well of the 7. The word Sheva, 7, is a holy number to the Hebrews. It's a sacred number. Sheva eventually becomes the word for swearing. And if you remember how the Jews like to do things, they like to put jots and tittles on things where they shouldn't. So when God says, you shouldn't take my name in vain, they said, great, we're going to swear oaths, but we're never going to use the name of God because we would be in violation of the Ten Commandments. So we'll pick a chair, we'll pick a desk, we'll pick a hat, a piece of food, we'll swear by it. And in this case, they would swear by the number 7. The literal term of this place is the well of the oath, or the well of the swearing. But really, it's just the number 7. So at this point, Isaac has dug 3 wells, Eshek, Sitna, Rehobot, and they'd all been troublesome places for him. But he goes and he builds an altar at Be'er Sheva. And we can take away a few things from this. Number one, the Jews would take the stones, the things that they would dig out of the ground in these wells, and they would set up altars on the outside. So in other words, they would see these dead stones and they would make them a living altar. But to have an altar, you have to have the name of God. And so he called on the Lord when he built this altar. The next thing we see is he pitched his tent, which in parlance means he staked claim to the area. And of course, he dug the well completely. And after this time, then Abimelech and Ahuzath and Phicol, the commander of his army, come to him. And Isaac said to them in verse 27, why have you come to me? You hated me. You wanted me gone. You wanted me out of your life. And you sent me away. And they say, we see plainly that the Lord has been with you. So we said, let there now be an oath between us, even between you and us, and let us make a covenant with you. Now, this is really interesting, because back in chapter 21, this is where Abraham had done the very same thing with Abimelech, probably a father or a grandfather. And they're doing the same thing here, but their oath is they don't want any harm to come to them. And I just love this, because this is their reasoning, verse 29. Just as we have not touched you and done anything to you, nothing but good, and have sent you away in peace, you are now blessed of the Lord. Well, we would say, oh, they didn't treat him good. But spiritually, I think they did. Spiritually, I think they helped him grow his faith and establish that relationship with God so that he would put his faith, his total faith, in God. So they made a feast, ate and drank. In the morning they rose up, exchanged oaths. Then Isaac sent them away, and they departed from him in peace. And it came about in verse 32, on the same day that Isaac's servants, so remember, this is the same day, Isaac's servants came and told him about the well which they had dug and said to him, we have found water. Now think about the coincidence here. Because if he could have done anything he wanted to these people, he was more powerful than they were. Instead, he invites them into his home. He shows them hospitality. He shows them the blessings that God has given him, and he enacts that same blessing on them. And you know what happens? Water shows up. And it says that he called the area Sheba, or Sheva. Therefore, the name of the city is Be'er Sheva to this day. So the king had come. He wanted peace. He stopped up the wells. He'd driven them off their land. And now they want to be friends. And the reason he gives is because he sees that Isaac has been blessed by the Lord. Have you ever had anybody come to you and say, I want what you have because I see goodness in you? You ever had anybody say, please help me understand how you function? How your life has gotten to be the way it is because I see happiness in you. I see the faith of God in you, and I want that. I need that in my life. You see, no matter what they tried to do to Isaac, Isaac kept getting stronger and stronger and stronger because there was something special about him. And if you think about Isaac, and if you were to apply a New Testament principle to him, you might say that Isaac had love and joy, and peace, and patience, and kindness, and goodness, and faithfulness, and gentleness, and self-control. But you see, they noticed these things in him, and so they wanted to be his friend. Maybe perhaps, though, they realized that the living God, the God of Abraham, was also the living God, the God of Isaac. They came together, made an agreement, made an oath. But think about your own neighbors, your coworkers, the classmates you might have at school. Do we know these people that we come into contact with? You see, even though the relationship that Isaac had with these people did not start out well, they at least knew him. They knew something about him because they saw it. They observed it. Can you say the same thing about your life? Can people observe you? Can they see the goodness from you? Can they see Christ working in your life out in the community? Is it possible that they notice how you live? And is it possible that God will even bless them through your works because they have come into contact with you? Or maybe you could ask yourself, is there a Abimelech in your life? Is there somebody who you are challenged with? Somebody who, on the surface, wants to destroy you, but in fact, what they're looking for is the graces of God. Let us live each day as Isaac has lived. Let us look for ways that we can bless each other, not just here in this community of people, but those that we come into contact with. I spent the last couple of days, and I'll close with this, watching, I love YouTube, I don't know why, but I watch a lot of YouTube. And it was this series called The World's Toughest Prisons. And I watched one in Malaysia, and I watched one in the Philippines. And let me tell you, I was in tears. These were people that were starving to death and were stealing food so that they could feed their families. And they were being put into this prison that was only for 800 people, but there were 3,000 people in this prison. And not one of these people had ever been tried and found guilty of their crime. They were waiting for their day in court. Some of them for 15 to 20 years. They were stacked on top of each other. The one in Malaysia, they literally, the cell boss, as they called him, in the middle of the night would clap his hands and they would have to turn over because they were all bunched up so close to each other on one side that they had to get them turned over so that they wouldn't get sores on their backs and on their arms and legs. They had fleas, they had lice, they had rats, they had everything. And I think about what I complain about and what goes on in my life. Folks, we have been blessed, mightily blessed. And we may not have an effect on people in communities that are across the world, but there are people in this community who need our help. And just those acts of blessing that we can invoke might get them to understand the goodness of Christ in our lives. If you're here tonight, and you have a need to have a closer and deeper relationship with Christ, with God, through that baptism that we talk about each and every time, then the opportunity is now. But if you're already a Christian, one that, as we see in the scriptures, called enlightened, that you're enlightened. In other words, the light shines in you. But maybe that light is flickering just a little bit because something's going on in your life and you need the support of your brothers and sisters here. Well, that opportunity is now. Don't wait. If you have need, now is the time. And I ask that you come forward while we stand and while we sing.